Everybody around seems so tight. Nothing's wrong. are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And we kick the show off with the music of Aretha Franklin, and we'll talk about Aretha a little bit later. But we wanted to welcome all of our listeners who are listening to us by internet around the world. And I'd like to alert you to a lot of the shows that we have on Uhuru Radio. Now, Uhuru Radio has a great show called Black Agenda Report, which is hosted by Glenn Ford, and Nellie Bailey sometimes gives him some support. And he has a real, very powerful editorial this week on Malefe Asante. He called him a red-baiting, McCarthyism, practicing McCarthyism in a dashiki. You know, Malefe Asante is a straight-up anti-communist. He's like J. Edgar Hoover with a dashiki on. But basically, that's what that's what Glenn talks about Malefe Asante. But check it out for yourself. We also heard from, we also want you to listen to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Simple. Also, O'Malley Ishatella Speaks, which is a great show, which has the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International. Also, Africa Live with Didon Sankara. We also have Reparations in Action, which is hosted by Penny Hess. We also have another show by Ron Bob Simple called Golden Sunday Sounds, and African International is hosted by Mike Etho. Now, we kick the show off with Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin was in Toronto the other week, and she did that song, giving him something that he can feel, and she said that she wanted to get greasy when she sang that, and that was from the pen of Curtis Mayfield, and Curtis Mayfield wrote, produced, and he played guitar on that particular song. And Aretha Franklin was, her band was conducted by a young man who, I used to live in the projects next door to him, Brother H.B. Barnum, and he was in town, and that's how I got to see the show. But anyway, we're going to continue. But before we continue, we need to let you know what we're going to be doing today. We have an interview with Ramon San Vicente about a brand new book called Rhymes to Reeducation. It's about a hip-hop curriculum, and it's going to, we'll let him talk about that, but it's coming out of Toronto, Canada, and a lot of the hip-hop community came together and put this together themselves. And we also are going to be paying tribute to El Hajj, Malik El Shabazz. Malcolm X would have been 89 years old on May 19th. We're going to be playing some music supporting Malcolm X, and we're also going to be listening to an interview that Kilu and Yasha did with Yuri Kochiyama. Yuri Kochiyama is a Japanese American who is still in the land of the living. She was born on the same day as Malcolm X, but Yuri was born in 1921. Yuri is still alive, but she is not doing that well, but she's still in the land of the living. And she did this interview with Kilu and Yasha many years ago, but she was a member of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the only, I know she was the only Japanese-American in there, but we're going to hear from her, and we're going to be playing some great music. Right now, we wanted to link the blues, and since I am a bluesologist, we're going to show you how Bob Marley was influenced by Lightnin' Hopkins. This is Mojo Hand by Lightnin' Hopkins, and then we're going to play Talking Blues by Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Here's a song about I'm going to lose out and get a little small mojo hand for you. Yeah, I'm going to bring it back and be happy with you. I'm gonna lose that one. I'm gonna get me a mojo hand. I'm gonna lose that one. Boys, I'm gonna get me a mojo hand. I didn't wanna fix my woman so. Can't have no other man. I lay down thinking, I was thinking about a mojo hen. I lay down thinking, I was thinking about a mojo hen. I wanna fix my woman so, can't have no other man. Cold ground on my bed last night. Rocks were my pillow too. Cold ground on my bed last night, baby. The rocks were my pillow too. You know I woke this morning wondering what in the world am I gonna do? I'm gone in the morning, if I don't be gone long. I'm gone in the morning, if I don't be gone very long. I'm gonna get my mojo hand, I'm gonna bring it back home. That's what I'm gonna do.
You know that the So who's gonna stay at home when the freedom fighters are fighting?
Ananga Def, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. Ananga Def is Wolof, a language that they speak in Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania. And there are many Wolof speakers spread out all around the world. People from the Gambia, Senegal, and Mauritania, they move around, and beautiful language. And we were listening to Robert Nestor and the Marley. They did a song called Robert Nestor Marley and the Wailers, pardon me, doing a song called Talking Blues. And Bob Marley was a blues man. He liked the blues, and he lifted the words "Cold Ground Was My Bed Last Night, Rock Stole My Pillow Too," straight from Lightnin' Hopkins out of Texas, Omawale Kafing's Stomping Ground. My good friend, he's not my friend, I've never met him, but Ross Baraka is the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. I knew his father, Amiri Baraka, but I have never met Ross Baraka. And Larry Ham recently became a Facebook friend of mine, and I know Larry Ham has been on Uhuru Radio many, many, many times, and he was very close to Amiri Baraka, and he's close to our brother Ross Baraka. But Chokwe Lumumba, his son, ran for the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and unfortunately he did not win. Chokwe Antar Lumumba. And I met Chokwe Lumumba one time, and I remember we had a conversation, and he mentioned the fact that he was a relative of Joe Louis. And Joe Louis was called the Brown Bomber, and he was maybe the hardest-hitting boxer in the history of the world. And he was the heavyweight champion from, let me check my notes right here, from 1937 until 1949, and Richard Wright, who went to the Bandung Conference. Richard Wright, of course, was a great writer. He was one time a member of the Communist Party, and he went to Bandung Conference, and I have a book called The Color Curtain, which he wrote about going to the Bandung Conference, but he wrote a song called King Joe about Joe Louis. Joe Louis was like, at that particular time, during World War II, you know, the whole question of white supremacy was and still is on the agenda. But, you know, Hitler was promoting the idea that the Europeans were superior to the Africans, to the Asians, and to anybody that was not from Europe, And, you know, King Joe went into Germany and, you know, basically, or he beat the heavyweight champion of the world, who was a German at that particular time. So Brother Richard Wright wrote a song called King Joe, and it was performed by Paul Robeson. He sang the song. Paul Robeson's birthday was the other day, by the way. And Count Basie's orchestra played the music, and I think it was Papa Joe Jones was the drummer, and Jimmy Rushin kept the time for Paul Robeson, kept Paul Robeson on the one. And I was told this by Max Roach. I used to speak with Mr. Roach, quite frequently, and he told me the story about this song, King Joe. But we're going to listen to it. It's 6 minutes long, and it's Paul Robeson's tribute to Joe Louis, and it was recorded in October of 1941.
Black-eyed peas as cornbread, what makes you so strong? Black-eyed peas as cornbread, what makes you so strong? Cornbread, say I come from where Joe Louis was born. Lord, I know a secret, swore I'd never tell. Lord, I know a secret, swore I'd never tell. I know what makes old Joe a hook and punch and roll like hell. Say Joe don't talk much, but he talks all the time. They say Joe don't talk much, he talks all the time. Now you can look at Joe, but you sure can't read his mind. Rabbit, say to the bee, what makes you sting so deep? Rabbit, say to the bee, what makes you sting so deep? Bee, say I sting like Joe, and rock 'em all to sleep.
Thank you.
say old Joe just lays down, sleeps all day long. They say old Joe just lays down, sleeps all day long. What old Joe does at night, Lord, sure ain't done him no wrong. Been in Cleveland, St. Louis, and Chicago, too. I've been in Cleveland, St. Louis, and Chicago, too. But the best is Harlem when a Joe Louis fight is through. I hate to see old Joe Louis step down. Lord, I hate to see old Joe Louis step down. But I bet $1 million no man will ever wear his crown. Bullfrog told Boar Weevil, Joe's done quit the ring. Bullfrog told Boar Weevil, Joe's done quit the ring. Boar Weevil say he ain't gone, and he's still the king.
Listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. That was the voice of Paul Robeson, backed up by the Count Basie Orchestra, and he was given a little aid, a little help from Jimmy Russian, Mr. 5x5, keeping time for Mr. Robeson. And Mr. Robeson, his son, Paul Robeson Jr., recently joined the Ancestors, and Paul Robeson was a young man who could speak 26 languages. He was an All-American football player. He was a lawyer, an actor, a singer, and I think it was Jimmy Castor. Had an album out called The E-Man. If there ever was an E-Man, I shouldn't say if there ever was an E-Man, but Paul Robeson was an E-Man.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is having its international conference in Philadelphia on August 16th and 17th, and you are invited. It's all happening at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles at 832 North Broad Street. Theme of the conference is Resist U.S. Wars and Occupations in the U.S. and Abroad. Reparations Now. Learn from Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the African Socialist International. See Ron Bob Simple as Marcus Garvey. Hear Glenn Ford speak on Ukraine and the Crisis of Empire. Listen to Lisa Davis expose the health attack on our community. The conference is free and open to the public. For more information, call 727-821-6621. Again, 727-821-6621 or visit blackisbackcoalition.org. Don't forget, August 16th and 17th in Philadelphia, Black is Back.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we're playing music made in the West but not of the West. And joining me on the line from Toronto, Canada, is Ramon San Vicente, who is the man behind a new book called Rhymes to Reeducation. It's a hip-hop curriculum resource guide for educators with social justice activists, and the website is rhymes2reeducation.com. And Ramon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, brother. How are you?
Real good. I guess we wanted to basically talk about why was there even a need for a book called Rhymes to Reeducation?
Yeah, for sure. So what we've been experiencing up here, and I know this is across North America, so it's not particular to our context here in Toronto, but it's a school system that, you know, continues to marginalize, particular students based on race, based on class, doesn't provide the opportunities for students to achieve their maximal potential. You know, there's systems that are in place that create barriers, and one of those things is, curriculum that is not, reflective of the cultures and the communities that we serve. And we know that this is a huge gap that's playing out. And so one of the things we also know is that, over the last 30 years, hip-hop has emerged as a dominant force in youth culture, and many would argue is the most dominant sort of youth culture across the globe today. So, and as a person who myself has grown up in the culture, as a participant and as an MC, and many other people in our city who've been that's been their journey, and they're now utilizing hip hop as education in various spaces and having great success with engaging young people in conversations that are empowering through hip hop. So we were like, okay, how do we mobilize this power and this potential of hip hop music and culture into a document that could be used in various spaces to kind of counteract some of what we're seeing in terms of the schooling of our young people. So that's kind of like the motivation, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, we have hip-hop shows in Toronto. I guess the first hip-hop show that we had on radio was The Fantastic Voyage by a young man by the name of Ron Nelson. But you were part of one of the second, maybe the second hip-hop radio show. Was it the Power Move on CIUT?
It was actually called the Masterman.
Master Plan.
Master Plan. We got the Master Plan.
how important were those two radio shows to what you? How did that help you with this current book now?
Yeah, for sure. Those shows, I think, were very important. Just in terms of the Black community, and Black youth community. In Toronto and surrounding areas. I remember, I was in Hamilton at the time and trying to put tin foil on my antenna just so I could, take in the sound and realizing that, wow, here you got Black voice and Black experiences emanating over, a radio airwave, which was brand new at the time. It was transformative to experience that. And so when we, when we had the opportunity, to also, have a show on the radio was big, and I wasn't so involved. My brother Power was mostly in John Bromsky and Motion, Sister Motion were mostly involved in that work with the radio program. But here you had, people who had definitely been coming from activism and various struggles in the Black community in Toronto, and then having, through their voice, through hip hop culture, having a voice to have this program. And so I think it was, for me, that whole experience being a part of that movement with the Master Plan show, and then being an MC in the group UBAD and on Blacklist Music, the record label, is foundational for me. The experiences I have moving into now writing curriculum as a teacher, and so that's what we're trying to also mobilize, is all that potential that comes from being a part of hip hop community and culture, and how we bring that now to educational spaces to empower our young people, right?
All right, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio now. Rhymes to Reeducation. Now, how do you rank social justice? We're talking about social justice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, this is a dumb question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. In 2014, social justice is kind of absent from current hip hop. It's not like it was during the heyday. Do you think that's actually the case?
Yeah, I think well, we moved into this era now where you have, you know, mainstream hip hop, commercial hip hop, supported by an industry and a mechanism that is, you know, part of the dominant sort of capitalist structure. That, you know, so there's that voice that is dominant everywhere on the radio. And so when people think about hip hop, they think about what they're hearing on you know, or seeing on BET, for example, right? Which is, I think, a very, you know, it's the loudest portion of hip hop, but it's not the only portion of hip hop. There's lots of underground hip hop that is, you know, talking back, speaking back, and resisting, you know, oppressive, you know, conditions in many ways. But doesn't get the same kind of support in radio play. So I think that's a reality. What we tried to do through the curriculum is, to be honest, we understand that there are different, you know, sub-genres within hip hop. And our focus was on, if you just talk about the musical aspect, our focus was on highlighting, engaging young people and understanding the social consciousness aspects of hip hop music and culture. And right. So we highlight that through the curriculum, right?
Well, let me ask you a question. Since we are speaking to the world as opposed to speaking to Toronto or Canada, could mm-hmm. you talk about some of the foundation hip-hop artists? I know, I guess Mishy Me was basically the first artist mm-hmm. signed to a major label in Toronto area. I may be mistaken, but I think Mishy Me, you know, when everybody thinks about hip-hop in Canada now, they automatically talk about Drake, maybe Cardinal Official, or Maestro Fresh West, but could you talk about some of the foundation people in Canadian hip-hop?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you have Mishy Me is, you know, a great example of that. You have people like, you know, you had some different crews that were operating in the city. So you have people like, you know, Dream Warriors and their camp who are doing, you know, been doing things in the city for a long time. You have
I don't want to cut you, but Dream Warriors, they came out of, St. Lucia, right?
Yeah, that's right. They got St. Lucian roots.
And they recorded with Marvin Gaye's wife, Janice Hunter's father. They did a song with him. He Slim and Slam. Malcolm X talks about him in his autobiography. But I just that's an aside. But go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Then you have, you know, like people like Rumble and Strong. You have people like, you know, Motion. You know, and what was called, you have people like Thrust, you know, and then you have the camp, like Cardinal comes out of a camp with like people like Socrates and Choclair, and, you know, so you had, you know, a lot, and a distinct flavor, I want to say, to the Toronto sort of, you know, hip hop identity, you know, because you have much more, I guess, presence of, you know, the island roots even coming through, the slang and the dialect, you know, in the music. And a lot of that. So, I mean, there's no way I could touch on all the camps. There's a lot of people been doing a lot of, like, ghetto concept people, you know, you had your Rexdale camp. So, I mean, a lot of foundational work happening in the city and not getting, you know, necessarily the same kind of airplay, you know, that it deserves,
right.
You know. But, yeah, and that those experiences, I think, are foundation for what we try to jump off within this curriculum. So you'll see a lot of those people who have roots and foundation in Toronto hip-hop actually being a part of the writing process for this curriculum. So that's, I think, one of the power of this collaborative that we, you know, need to talk about, because it's not about traditionally, you know, when you write curriculum, it's traditionally people who are educators in classrooms who get together and they're writing, you know, curriculum from their perspective and their lens. But this was very much about, you know, people who living and breathing in the hip-hop community, now putting that down into lesson plan kind of format that could be engaged in multiple spaces to talk about issues of, you know, that are relevant to young people. So I think that's a big first, you know, in our context.
So this is basically coming from the artists themselves, or writing, created this curriculum themselves, as opposed to someone who
that's
got a degree,
right.
Somebody who got a degree from
that's
Harvard
right.
or the U of T
that's
or.
Right.
That's
right. So there's different ways of knowing. And I mean, even to build on that, I mean, many of these people also have, you know, their degrees. They might have their, you know, their B.Ed., their M.Ed. They might have who knows what kind of degrees, you know, they might have, you know, formal institution and otherwise. You know what I'm saying? So they're bringing those multiple perspectives. So you have breakdancers who are writing, MCs, DJs, you know, graffiti artists, producers, you know, who are bringing those multiple perspectives to this curriculum. So I think it's a pretty revolutionary in that sense of bringing in other ways of knowing to this whole thing about teaching and what is teaching and learning, you know what I'm saying?
Could you talk about the launch that you had? I think it was at York Woods Library. How did that come out? What was the turnout, and how did people respond to the launch of Rhymes to Reeducation?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we had a lot of excitement in the city, you know, and so it was almost like this bubble waiting to burst, you know. And so when I talk about the curriculum, it's not that, you know, people weren't doing this kind of work in this city for a long time, but I think the project allowed people to come together in a unified kind of way and build some energy around exploring hip-hop as critical pedagogy in this city. So we had a lot of people come out to that book launch, you know, from various walks of life. We had some elders come out. We had, you know, teachers who work in the school board come out. We had a school board trustee. We had a school board superintendent. We had administrators. We had community-based educators. We had youth who came and dropped some spoken word pieces. You know, and because this is hip-hop, you know, this was, you know, one of the comments I got back after the book launch was, I've never been to a book launch like that before, because it was, you know, we had all the sort of the different art forms and cultural, you know, aspects represented in the book launch. So you had, you know, we had the word, the sound, and the power. We had the MCs, we had the DJ, we had a breakdance element, we had a spoken word element, we had some graffiti pieces up in the background, and it was a great celebration of what's come out of, you know, hip-hop community here in Toronto. So was excited about that, and a lot of people bought a lot of books, which is always nice to support in the movement, you know.
Let me ask you a question. Now, internationally, hip-hop is an international movement. North America, how do you think hip-hop in 2014 compares with hip-hop in other parts of the world? Like in say, a place like Senegal, hip-hop was real big in the, you know, one of the recent elections, and some hip-hop artists talk about the struggle against HIV and... Here in North America, I know there are people that are doing that type of work, but do you think there's a big difference between what hip-hop artists are saying internationally, or could you just talk about how do you see that?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and it's a difficult one, because I'm it's hard for me to speak about the scenes in other, you know, in other countries that I haven't visited. I'm not an intimate part of those scenes, but I mean, from the perspective where I sit in Canada, you know, I think, you know, in Toronto, there was a, like, you know, compared to our 80s and 90s, you know, early 90s, where there was like an obvious, you know, political or politicized movement happening in hip hop culture here in the city, you know, and so you felt that through the music and the way that the music was expressed, you know, in a more dominant kind of way. And I feel like, you know, maybe we're in a different space now, where we're definitely in a different time zone and experience now, where, you know, we need to bring back some of that, you know, social, political consciousness and activism, as I see it here in this city anyways. And what I do hear about, you know, hip hop from other spaces where, you know, some of those movements are a little bit more pronounced, maybe the struggle is a little bit more, you know, I don't know what the word would be, but it's, you know, it's in your face, it's there, you know, then we're also seeing and hearing music that reflects that, I think, in a more dominant kind of way. At least that's my kind of outsider's perspective, without having visited these countries myself, you know.
You listened to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Now, how have the Canadian, the media, the total media treated not hip-hop, but Canadian hip-hop? How much play does Canadian hip-hop get on radio, TV, and even the, we have a black-owned and operated radio station here in Toronto called G98, and it was given to our community by the Conservative Party. How do they treat not just them, but how does the media treat Canadian hip-hop, not hip-hop generally, but specifically Canadian hip-hop?
Well, let me summarize that by limited exposure. You know, limited exposure, and I think, you know, similar to, you know, probably other spaces that you have, you know, it's like the media that latches on. They get one or two artists, they latch onto them, and then they rinse them like there's no tomorrow. And then, you know, the underground artists, other artists aren't getting to play, right? So that's the beauty of community radio. That's the beauty of the kind of stuff that you've been doing on your program over many years, you know, and providing an opportunity for you know, artists who are voicing, you know, the kinds of issues and topics that we need to be talking about. That's the beauty of something like the Master Plan Show and you know, even, you know, the Power Move back to Fantastic Voyage program on 88.1. Those programs are really, really necessary, and they're so necessary because, you know, the other, you know, mainstream media is not covering, right? They're not covering in the way that it needs to happen, you know, the voices of young people that are expressing through hip-hop music. So,
is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just want to finish by saying that, like, you know, the learning that's occurred, I guess, through this collaborative or collaboration around producing a hip-hop curriculum resource that focuses on critical pedagogy, on social justice issues, has been huge for all of us that's been involved. It's been a great, opportunity to really start to explore, you know, what we really need to be exploring in our classrooms and with our students. So we're looking forward to seeing where this could possibly go and how we can continue to learn and build from this movement. So thank you so much for having me on the show and the opportunity to talk about this. Appreciate it.
All right. We need to possibly get you back to maybe come in and suggest some of the artists that we could play on.
Yeah, for sure.
On the show.
And I have to big up, like, we had, you know, Norman, over 15 writers on this project. So I got to big up all the writers, you know, who've been a part of this movement and all the youth who've been supporting and teachers who've been supporting. It's been, and I'm calling it a movement because that's really what it has been, you know, and I haven't experienced that in a little while in this city, at least that I've been a part of. So I've been happy to be a part of that movement from, you know, Education Entertainment West and Equity and Inclusive Schools have been supporting that. So it's been big. So thank you.
All right, sir. Take care. And you have been listening to Roman San Vicente, the person behind Rhymes to Reeducation, and Diasporic Music continues on Uhuru Radio.
Yo, you see what they got you wear? That's your ass, yo.
Turn me up. I wanna hear the music.
Yeah.
I wanna feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
Nothing gained, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high. From the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave. And I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me. Support me or snake me. Either way I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream. Just set the scene. Get the cream like how you mean. Straight up, wanna let this be. Puppet on a string, like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave.
Do it, and do it, and do it.
Don't
just want more. Speaking for my people, screaming hardcore. Living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought? I was gonna rise, do my thing, get my piece of the pie. You're holding your breath for great God out the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow a lot of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. And just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, steaming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you're only perpetrating yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my motto. Taking charge, you got what it takes to make it, make it all.
Yo, Mitch, check 1-2, yo. Don't even let them try to play you like that, you know what I'm saying? They don't even know who you is, you know what I'm saying? But let them know, G, you're Queen B, alright? You know what I'm saying? Mess with Mitch, don't even let them play you like that, yo. Give them the real shit, Mitch. Alright, Mitch? Right, Mitch? Right, Mitch?
Everybody got a problem, but of course, the world got a problem, and it's yours. That's why I wrote this rhyme. You can quote this line, cause I focus mine. Living in some hopeless times, or so it seems. Never let go of your dreams, nah, man.
Nah, man,
do what you got to do.
Do it and do it and do it.
Just do what you got to do.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio, and we just heard Mishimi and Marion McCabe. We're going to deal with some Marion McCabe right now. Marion McCabe was a huge fan of Malcolm X, and her daughter, Bongi McCabe, who unfortunately died in giving birth in Guinea. In Secretariat's Guinea, Bongi wrote this song about Malcolm X, and it is called Malcolm X, but Malcolm X was, his birthday would have been 89 years old on May the 19th, and we are paying tribute to Malcolm X, but right now we wanted to listen to Marion McCabe singing about Malcolm X, and the words from this same song came from the pen of the late Bongi McCabe, the daughter of Marion McCabe.
Everybody seems to be preaching revolution. Though no one ever seems to show appreciation. Who brought about a new generation? Yeah, to that man who brought about a new black nation. Ah, do you remember Malcolm? Do you remember him, Malcolm? Yeah, brother Malcolm. Don't you know he was a great man? Oh, yeah. People away from oppression. But from day to day, Malcolm lived for liberation. Yeah, yeah. Until that man with a gun took away his devotion.
Malcolm X would have been 89 years old on May the 19th. He was born in 1925, and the year of 1925 was the year that Frantz Fanon was born, Robert Williams was born. The year of 1925 produced a lot of great men and women, and Malcolm from North America, Frantz Fanon from the Caribbean and Africa, because he did live and work in Algeria, and of course Robert Franklin Williams was from North America, but he lived in Cuba and in China. So we are always attempt to be as international as we can. But right now we wanted to play a song called Malcolm Malcolm Semper Malcolm by Archie Shepp, and Malcolm Semper Malcolm could have been called Medgar Semper Medgar, because Medgar Evers was the leader of the Jackson, Mississippi chapter of the NAACP. And Archie Shepp has said that, you know, this could have been called Medgar Semper Medgar. But this is Archie Shepp doing Malcolm Semper Malcolm.
A song is not what it seems. A tomb, perhaps. Bird whistled while even America listened. We play, but we aren't always dumb. We are murdered in amphitheaters, on the podium of the Audubon, the Earl. Philadelphia, 1945. Malcolm, my people, dear God, Malcolm.
Thank you. right. Death broke us. The Potomac in a scarlet shawl. The pillow beneath you is not here. Take this axe, Cannibal kiss, and turn it into a revolution. Flies that hover over your yellow encrusted eye. Are the centurions of Hannibal wondering, wondering at you lying there?
Brother Malcolm, 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 br Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm,
Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, Brother Malcolm.
Thank you.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, playing some music from Archie Shepp, dedicated to El Hajj Malik El Shabazz and Malcolm X, also known as Omar Wally. We just listened to Archie Shepp doing Brother Malcolm. We heard Archie Shepp doing Poem for Malcolm, and then we kicked the set off with Archie Shepp's Malcolm, Malcolm, Semper Malcolm. And I never met Archie Shepp. That is definitely not true. Archie Shepp is a very good, close friend of mine. But the first time I saw Archie Shepp was in Newark, New Jersey, in Amiri Baraka's office. It was upstairs in the Spirit House, and I didn't meet him, but he was there. And I was in Newark, New Jersey, doing something I don't even remember. But I did meet him then. I met him in the 70s, but I was in awe of him because I had read his column in Downbeat magazine. He wrote a column in Downbeat magazine, and I bought all of his music. He did this album called Fire Music, which Malcolm Semper Malcolm was on. And he wrote these columns, and he was played piano. He played saxophone, he sang, he wrote poetry, and he was a playwright. And I was really impressed by Archie Shepp. And we're going to move on. And Malcolm X had an impact on the world in the Caribbean. He moved Dennis Brown to record a song called Malcolm X. This is the Prince of Reggae. This is the man who Bob Marley anointed. The Prince of Reggae, this is Dennis Brown doing his rendition of Malcolm X.
The hidden brutality. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we were listening to the music of the Crown Prince of Reggae, Dennis Brown, his rendition of Malcolm X, and we are going to be playing some music from, we're finished music. We're going to be listening to an interview with Yuri Kochiyama. Yuri Kochiyama is a Japanese-American. I think she was born in San Pedro, California. She's still in the land of the living. She was born on May 19th, 1921. Also, Ho Chi Minh was born on May 19th, 18-something. You guys got access. You can probably look on your phone and get it, but Ho Chi Minh was born on May 19th. Also, Lorraine Hansberry was born on May 19th. So you have Malcolm, you have Yuri, you have Ho Chi Minh, you have Lorraine Hansberry. May 19th is a very heavy, heavy day. And I am not into astrology, so whatever that means, they were born on that day. But astrologically, if you are into the moons and the stars, you can figure it out. But they were born on the same day. But Yuri Kochiyama grew up in California, and she was interned with a lot of other Japanese people because when World War II broke out, you know, they did not trust the American ruling class did a number on Japanese Americans and put them in basically concentration camps. So Yuri was part of that. She moved to New York, and she was a part of the human rights struggle, and she met Malcolm and invited Malcolm to her house and became a member of the Organization of Afro-American Unity. I think she probably was the only Asian American that was a member. But we're going to be listening to Yuri Kochiyama. She's being interviewed by Kilu Inyasha, who is a former Black Panther and a journalist who has been on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio many times. So this is Yuri Kochiyama being interviewed by Kilu Inyasha.
Good evening and welcome to Freedom is a Constant Struggle with your host Kilu Inyasha, engineered by Dina Boyer. I'm very pleased to welcome as our guest this evening Yuri Kochiyama. She's a living legend. She knew Malcolm X, and Malcolm X's birthday is coming up. It's going to be celebrated on the 19th, and Yuri Kochiyama happens to have the same birthday. And she met and worked with Malcolm in Harlem. She lived in Harlem for 40 years. And Yuri Kochiyama, welcome to Freedom is a Constant Struggle. So good to have you back.
Well, thank you so much, Kayla. It's kind of you to invite me.
Well, it's a joy to have you, and an honor. I feel very privileged to even know you. You're such a living legend. But I do want to ask you right off. I should alert my viewers that two books have been written. You wrote your memoir, Passing It On. Excellent, I've read it. And Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama, was written by Diane Fugino. And it's a biography. And when I read Diane's book, I learned that there was a Japanese delegation that came to visit you and wanted to meet Malcolm. Will you elaborate on that?
Oh, yes. This was in 1964, about June. So when you think of the year 1964, you know that's only about half a year before Malcolm was assassinated.
Right.
But anyway, these hibakusha, there was a group of 45, and hibakusha means atom bomb victim. They came not just to America, they went on to Europe and all the way to Moscow to speak out against nuclear proliferation.
Right.
and the group had heard the name Malcolm. I don't know exactly how they even thought about Malcolm, because, you know, the American press did not have a very good, I mean, they would not show any kind of a good image of Malcolm. But the Japanese knew that black people admired him and wondered also, however, why America would be afraid of one lone black man. They wanted to know what Malcolm X was like. And so they asked if there was a way of meeting Malcolm and hearing him speak. And that's when he came. We lived in Harlem, and he came to
me. And that was we, meaning you and your husband and six children, right?
Right, yes. people told us, Malcolm's not going to go to your house. He doesn't know you, and it's dangerous for him right now. What made you think that he might come? Well, I said, well, it's true, I'm not sure. I wrote to him. I did not hear from him, but his office called and said they would do whatever they could that he might come. And he did. And our place was jam-packed. We lived in a housing project in Harlem. And I wasn't sure he was going to come, so I didn't want to advertise it too much and have people come, and then they'll wonder what happened that he didn't come. But a lot of people showed. Our house was jam-packed. And Malcolm did come, and we were all so surprised and just so tickled. People were really more amazed that he would take the chance of coming to a strange home of people he didn't even know anything about, when there were so many rumors that something might happen to Malcolm. When he did come, of course, the people were just so excited. Everybody wanted to shake his hand. They didn't know if he would shake the hands of white people or what. But Malcolm just surprised everyone. He was so warm to everyone, no matter what color. And people were just astounded that Malcolm has that wonderful way. You could help me on some adjectives. You know, Malcolm,
he had charisma.
Charisma, that's
right.
The word.
Yes.
He has so
really
much
is.
Charisma.
Right.
And yet, he's so down to earth. Yeah.
Exactly.
And he shook hands with everybody, regardless of what color, black or white or Latino, Asian. And people couldn't believe that this is the Malcolm X they've read about in American newspapers.
Who's always portrayed as a hater and
right.
hateful and all that.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about, you had already met Malcolm before he came to the house.
Right.
And you did work with him, I believe.
Well, no, I was just one of thousands of, you know, followers.
Oh, yeah. I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that I wanted you to talk about a little bit about was you were mentioning earlier that he wasn't just a black man, he was a black experience.
Right.
Will you talk about that a little
bit? Yes, I would like to quote that. I don't know who wrote it, but I think it's beautiful that it just fits him, that Malcolm was not just a black man. He was the black experience. He was bathed in blackness, and yet he repudiated his slave name and just added an X, the unknown, the possibility of what might be, the reality of what he became. And I think that's so beautiful, and I'm sorry I don't know who the author is.
Right. Well, he did change his name to Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz. Yes.
Right.
And Alhaj, I believe, indicates that you've made the pilgrimage to Mecca.
Right.
And when he did go to Mecca, was it in 64?
Yes.
Talk about how that changed him a little bit.
Yes, that certainly did change him, but I want to also credit Malcolm's sister, Ella Collins, who made an influence in Malcolm's life, because she wanted Malcolm to grow up as a possible leader of his people. And Malcolm, almost like he knew what was in store for him, he just had it inside of him, a very deep love for his people, and he wanted to know as much of history of Africans and Black Americans here, because one day he wanted to be able to share all that he would learn. And I think with the question, however, you asked was
basically when he came back from his pilgrimage to Mecca, he had a different outlook. For example, when we were talking earlier, we talked about how he was very hostile toward whites in his Black nationalist period.
Right.
And the beauty of Malcolm was how he kept growing and changing.
Yes.
From when he was a hustler and a pimp in Harlem,
right.
And in Detroit, he was known as Detroit Red,
uh-huh.
You know, and he was imprisoned for 9 years, during which he took the he studied hard, became a Muslim, copied every word in the dictionary, became very, very articulate,
right.
And well-read,
mm-hmm.
And when he came out, that's how he became so popular so right away, because he was so well-spoken and so
mm-hmm.
Able to capture an audience.
Right, and that's why the U.S. government began to see him as a threat, because Malcolm's name went out all over, and of course, Malcolm did actually go to Africa, to about 11 countries, I think.
Right, Tanzania, and he met Ghana, Egypt.
Yes.
Yeah.
He met all the most progressive leaders of
right,
Africa.
Right, he met heads of state, yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. Right.
And
he even met Castro in Cuba.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, he did. And he, the name Vicky Garvin, I hope, is familiar to people. She is almost like a woman, Malcolm X, but she perhaps is not so well known because she lives so much of her life in Africa.
Uh-huh.
And in 1964, when Malcolm went to Ghana, she's the one who introduced Malcolm to the international community. And people were very, very impressed, especially the Chinese ambassador. And the Chinese ambassador practically begged Malcolm, please come to China. They have not met many Black leaders in China.
Right.
But Malcolm felt he couldn't, because he had so many commitments he had already made.
Uh-huh.
And so he asked if Vicky Garvin could go to China for
right.
him. And she did. And at first, Vicky didn't know how long she would stay, but she said, okay, she would go for Malcolm. And she went there, and people thought, oh, she may stay a week or two. She stayed 10 years.
Wow.
Yes.
In the People's Republic of China.
Yes.
During what period? What, in the 70s?
In the 60s and 70s.
60s and 70s.
Yes.
All and right.
It's sad that some, I mean, activists don't know her name, because I think she did so much of her work in Africa.
Oh, all right.
Yeah,
yeah.
In the Middle East.
Well, we're
she died in Queens, you know, in New York, but she was quite old then, and it's sad that people are not aware, and I hope someone like you, as you've been teaching all of us, will teach not just black people, but everybody about the life of Vicki Garvin, too.
Yes, well, I'll have to do some research. I'll have to take that on.
There hasn't been enough about her.
Right, yeah, yes. She sounds fascinating.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to Malcolm, and I also want to invite our viewers to call in if they have a question to 621-4473, our live line. And we're speaking with Yuri Kochiyama, who was also, by the way, present when Malcolm X was assassinated in the Audubon Ballroom, February 21st, I believe, 1965.
Right.
And Yuri was rushed to him and literally cradled his head in her lap as he was dying. And he was a tremendous loss to our struggle. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that China wanted Malcolm to come because eventually the Black Panther Party members went. A delegation, Huey and Emory Douglas and Huey Newton and some others were received by Zhou Enlai. In China, and that was quite an event.
Yes, oh yeah.
But of course, the Black Panther Party was Malcolm X all the way, taking him.
Oh, I think every black organization, was influenced by Malcolm.
They were very much
whether it was SNCC or what's the other group, same time as SNCC.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and
there was even RAM,
Revolutionary Action Movement,
which Muhammad Ahmed's group. And actually, Malcolm was a part of it, but they couldn't let anyone know. I mean, you know, the FBI, CIA were just trailing Malcolm everywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because Malcolm was not a capitalist. He said, you show me a capitalist, I'll show you a bloodsucker.
Right. Yes. And as although the white press was very, very unkind to Malcolm, Malcolm said, I am an extremist, and I am not ashamed of it.
Right.
The condition that my people suffered were...
Extreme
very
poverty, racism. Yes,
right. That
exploitation.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I remember.
And so that modern moderate medicine could not cure American racism. And,
yes. Yes.
I mean, he couldn't cure
extremism with moderate medicine. Right.
Right. And I like the way he. You know, he always. Made these quotes. One was, if a cat had kittens in the oven, they would not be biscuits. And he would follow it up with, I was born in America, but I'm not an American. I am a victim of America.
And he was
very clear, and that's why... As a leader at that time, he was different from the...
Listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, sometimes called Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And we were listening to Yuri Kochiyama. I had the pleasure of meeting Yuri Kochiyama in the early 70s in Harlem, New York. I saw Yuri Kochiyama speak in 1990 at the Malcolm X Conference. Yuri Kochiyama came to Toronto on several occasions, and on one occasion I had the pleasure of sharing the microphone with her, speaking at a film about Malcolm X. And I stayed in contact with Yuri for many, many years until she became ill. One of the nicest human beings that you could ever meet. Maya Angelou. Maya Angelou is another story. At one time, Maya Angelou was very close to El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. Very close to El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. There was a group of women in New York City who when Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, it was a group of women, Abby Lincoln, Aminata Museka, the same person, Maya Angelou, Rosa Guy, a sister. Rosa Guy was, Rosa Guy, I think she just passed away recently, last couple of years. She was from Trinidad and Tobago. They had a women's organization. And when Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, these sisters actually tore the United Nations up. I mean, they actually fought the police and the guards at the United Nations, and Maya Angelou was a part of that. And Maya Angelou welcomed Malcolm X to Ghana when she was living there, and she came back to the United States basically to be a part of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which Yuri Kochiyama was a member of. And Maya landed, and Malcolm was killed a couple of days after Maya landed. And so she was never able to work with Malcolm directly, but she left Africa to work with El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. And we have a clip of Maya Angelou talking about her relationship to Malcolm X. And I would like to thank Shira and for teching the show today. I would also like to thank Sandra for her assistance as well. And last week we ran out of time when I was speaking with Kali Akuno, but Kali Akuno, the show has been put up, so I would like to thank Shira and Sandra. And we're going to listen to Maya Angelou. We're also going to listen to Leon Thomas, and we will see you in the whirlwind. Take care.
What should young people know about Malcolm X?
About Malcolm X?
Mm-hmm. That perhaps they don't know, that you have a particular perspective on.
Well, this is going to sound strange and maybe even frivolous, but it isn't. They should know he had an incredible sense of humor. They should know that about Martin, too. Martin King had an incredible sense of humor. One of the things some historians do, and one of the mistakes made, is the historian, and social historian in particular, oftentimes recreate the man or woman as larger than life, which puts the person beyond the reach of a young person. So, if Malcolm and Martin and Abraham Lincoln and Kennedy, if Dr. Du Bois and Mary McLeod Bethune are beyond their reach, then they say, well, there's nothing I can do. Those people were bigger than life. I'm just myself. I was born in Boston. I'm just myself. I was born in Kansas City. What can I do? So the wisest thing is to make the people accessible. Show their wiles and their wits and their warts. Show them. So a person can say, you know, given the same circumstance, I think I'd have done that too. I'd like to think I could have done that. So what both men, I knew Malcolm much better than Dr. King. But Malcolm was a faithful man, great loving person who really loved black people. And then one of the most courageous persons I've ever known. Courage is the most important of all the virtues, because without courage you can't practice any other virtue consistently. You can't be consistently kind. consistently fair, merciful, just, loving. You cannot. Malcolm, having said that all whites were blue-eyed devils, all dislikes of them, he went to Mecca, and he came to West Africa, and he said, I have met white-skinned, blue-eyed men who I openly call brother. I was wrong. Now, it takes a great deal of courage to say that, even when the person feels that they were wrong. I see this today. People who don't believe what they say, but because they have the habit of saying it and are known as saying it, they're afraid to say, listen, everybody, you remember what I said last week? I don't believe that. So among other things, his courage and his exquisite sense of humor, young people should be reading. Read the books. Read the books.
El Haj Malik Shabazz.
Oh, know he died. Just to set me free. Yes, Malcolm, go home. But he's not forgotten. He died to save me. Gave me my dignity.
Listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.